This is the Saturday Night Live Friday Speaker Meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous held at Westgate West in San Jose, California on January the 28th, 2000. Our speaker is Steve G. of San Jose, California. The original recording of this meeting is kept in the SNL Tape Library. Please observe the traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous and do not play this recording for commercial or entertainment purposes. Please do not break the anonymity of the speakers or any other AA member at the public level. Thank you.
My name is Steve Galanda, and I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is December 26, 1981. We're going to do something different tonight once again, 2 weeks running. This is for the new people here. We have 4 newcomers, we have 20 court cards, and we have 5 visitors. You know, a sobriety birthday is real important to me. You know, I was speaking with some people that I had dinner with, and for me lately it's been like a holiday when I have a sobriety birthday, and usually it's a pretty long holiday. You know, I had my birthday last month, and like I've been on fire about my sobriety lately, and it's a good feeling, you know, to be sober and to like pick up a chip every year. And it's just a real good feeling. So what I would like to do tonight is, you know, for the benefit of the new people here, how many people over 1 year have a sobriety birth date? Over 1 year. Stand up, please. Just stand up. You know, as you can tell here, this is well over half of the group. Over 1 year sobriety, you know, that's pretty heavy. You know, I mean, that just shows me that this program works. You know, like I had like a quiet afternoon with myself today. I did my little routine, you know, polished my boots and ironed my pants and ironed a T-shirt. Turned out to be the wrong shirt to wear tonight. I had to go buy one after I had dinner at Effie's with a couple friends of mine. But, you know, I was thinking about something. You know, sometimes I really didn't put a lot of thought into what I was going to say tonight because I believe everything that I say is what I've learned here, and a lot of it comes from my heart, you know, and it's something honest that comes out of me. And I sometimes have like inspirations and thoughts and comparisons with movies. It could be anything, you know, and I was thinking of the movie Cat Ballou, you know, and Lee Marvin was in it. And my favorite part is where he's leaning up against the wall on his horse, and he's all drunk, you know. And further on in the movie, you know, he ends up getting sober, and he's got like a war chest that he has. He's got his, you know, he's got his 2 guns in there, and he's got his black shirt, and he's got his black hat, and he's got his Bonnaroos. I mean, that would be my definition of what he had in there, in the box, you know. And there's some outlaw that's coming into town. You know, I don't know if it's Liberty Valance or whatever, but so anyhow, he puts all his duds on, and he ends up facing Liberty Valance, and you know, just the ritual. That's what I feel—the ritual that he went through today. You know, like, and so anyhow, he ends up meeting Liberty Valance and shoots him, and you know, and Jane Fonda, everybody live happily ever after. You know, but I was thinking about that today. You know, it's important for me to. You know, let you people know who I am, and you know, it's just part of the program for me. I have to let you know who I am so you can identify with me, you know, because I believe today, like, there's some meetings that talk about we all agree there's no drunkologues. Well, if I go to that meeting, doesn't mean I agree with it. You know, I think it's very important that people identify with us once we get here, you know, and so that's what I'm going to do tonight. I'm going to tell you what it used to be like for me, and I'm going to kind of get into a little bit of detail tonight. It's been a little bit, usually I don't really get into detail, but I think it's important to let you know, like, where I've come from. You know, I'm Portuguese, born and raised here in Santa Clara Valley. Our family's from Evergreen. So I'm a California native. I've seen this valley change much like I've seen AA change, you know, since I've been in these rooms. And, you know, I grew up I grew up in a dysfunctional family, which is used today. And really, as I look back on it, it was. You know, my mother and father, they divorced at a very early age, when I was very young. And I remember when my mother had hooked up with another man, and you know, she already had two kids by my father. And I remember the feelings that, you know, I didn't feel wanted. You know, and as I look back at that now, that affected my self-esteem. Everything I'm going to say about what it was like for me has affected me in my life where I look back at it now, you know. Also, you know, I felt insecure. You know, I felt insecure because I didn't feel wanted. I didn't feel loved. And consequently, those type of feelings manifested for me in my alcoholism. And, you know, my father was a full-blown alcoholic from the minute I was born till the day he died. I can remember going to a bar called Flasky's in downtown Los Gatos, and I used to go in there with him. That's when a kid could go in and hang out with his dad. I remember they used to prop me up on the bar, and they would put 50-cent pieces in my eye. You know, if I could keep them in there, they'd let me have them, you know. And that was kind of like my first introduction to the bar life, you know. And as years went by with my dad, I could still remember the rituals he used to go through on a Friday night like tonight. He'd get his clothes out of the cleaners, all pressed in Bonnaroo, have me shine his shoes for him, and he would go out. That was his thing. He would go out to whatever bar he was going to. Sometimes I would go with him. I mean, go out, eat, and then he'd drop me off back at home. But I remember those things today. You know, I remember up in Holy City, there used to be a bar up there. And my dad had a convertible at the time. I remember sitting in that car for him, waiting for him to come out, you know. And there's many other bars I can tell you that I remember sitting in the car and waiting for him to come out. I mean, I knew what he was doing in there. He was drinking beer. He was in there drinking, you know, and I remember times I used to go into the bar and say, "Dad, come on, let's go. I want to go. You know, I want to go home. Or I want to do something. I want to go." You know, and I remember it sometimes that "I want to go" turned into another couple hours. "Oh yeah, yeah, I'll be right there." I remember all those things today as I look back at it. You know, and you know, consequently, like I just said, those things they played a part of my upbringing. You know, a lot of us get here you know, to make a comparison, a lot of us get here and we really don't have parental guidance. We're never like told the difference between right and wrong. And that's the way it was for me when I was a kid. You know, I'm like, the definition of this is black and white. You know, like when I do things wrong, I find out about it, you know, by doing wrong things. And that's how I would learn. And that's how I kind of had to learn all my life is, you know, I would do something wrong and I would pick up the tab for it. And, you know, that carried on right up to when I started drinking and stuff, you know, being insecure. Then I started, like, bouncing back between parent, mother, and father, you know, alcoholic, full-blown alcoholic father. My mother had a new love interest. I had felt like another mouth. So I was feeling those insecurities and stuff, and I didn't feel any love, you know. You know, when we stood up tonight for the newcomers, you know, that's what we're trying to give you, is some love, you know, unconditional love. And that's what was lacking, you know, in my life when I came up. You know, like, as I look back at it now, you know, I could say that I probably had a lot of self-pity, you know, going on within myself over the years. And today, you know what, I don't feel sorry for myself today. You know what, if I do things, I pick up the tab for it, you know. And this program has taught me that everything just about what I do these days is a big learning experience for me. You know, and as long as I continue to learn from my mistakes, try to correct them, that usually my life will get better. But anyhow, at that early age, you know, I got older, bounced back and forth. I had problems like going to school because I was going to so many different schools all the time that, you know, it was hard for me to make friends, you know, so I would do things to get attention. You know, as I look back at it now, I had like this day and age, I had attention deficit disorder. You know, that's what it actually was. I would do things to get kids' attention so they would like me, you know, and, you know, other things that, like, I remember is my father being an alcoholic. I was really athletic when I was a kid, and there's never one time that my father ever came to a baseball game or a football game or a basketball game. You know what? And those are things that I had learned then and within myself that I have passed on as far as giving that type of recognition to my son today. You know, so on the pros and cons of that, I mean, my son has learned through me, you know, like a legacy and stuff. And I'll talk more about him later. But, you know, so I went to Lincoln High School. I'm a product of the 60s, okay? There's a couple people here tonight that I know, you know, probably know what I'm talking about. You know, there was a lot of unrest going on in the United States, Vietnam War, hippies, free love. There were BNs. There was a Fillmore West. There was the Barn up in Scotts Valley where Janis Joplin used to play. There was a Chateau Liberté up in the Santa Cruz Mountains where a lot of people used to go and party. And that's where you could really get loose. I was the kind of alcoholic that liked to really get loose. And, you know, so that's kind of like the time era I came from. And there was a lot of drugs involved in my story. And I probably did anything and everything that was available at that time. You know, I have done everything from sniff glue to shoot heroin, you know, and anything in between. You know, if it changed the way I felt, I wanted some. You know, if somebody told me that they took some LSD and they had hallucinated about a griffin on a Coors can, I would want to have some of that. You know, I mean, that's the way I was. I was always into experimentation and stuff, you know. And so, you know, primarily, though, during that time is that, you know, I did drink. I really can't tell you the first time that I really seriously got busy drinking, but I remember living with my father. I would, you know, drink his beer sometimes, you know, and have a couple beers. And I can almost remember the first time I got drunk. We were living in the state of Washington, and there was a store on the corner, and I used to go in there anyhow, and I used to steal my cigarettes out of there. Just go in there, they'd be in the back, grab me a cart. I mean, I kept myself supplied that way. And we had some people over at my house, and I remember going to that store and stealing wine. And needless to say, we got really bombed. I mean, all of us. I mean, we were all passed out, and you know, all of us thinking we got lucky the next day. And there was a couple girls there and stuff, and I don't know, I still can't remember today whether I got lucky or not, you know, but I know I woke up the next morning in a puddle of vomit, and it wasn't a real pretty picture to see. So, you know, that's right then and there, that tells you that I basically, when I started out as a blackout drinker, I mean, I was blacked out. I don't remember nothing, you know, and so consequently, that stuff carried on for me all the time that I drank. I would drink to get drunk, usually to pass out, I mean, or blackout, one or the other. And that's how my drinking was. But, you know, a lot of things play into my early drinking and stuff. You know, I talk about the 60s and stuff, and in San Jose at the time, they had a lot of BNs, you know, and like, to go to a BN, you had a BN, you know, like you go down there, drop some reds, drink some little Pagan Pink, get yourself a bottle of Red Mountain wine for $1.59. You know, go check out all the dollies that are there that day, you know. And I really can't remember ever heard any music when I was there. I was more interested just going there and getting loaded and see how loaded everybody else was. You know, and you know, during that time, there was a lot of barbiturates on the street. They call them fender benders. I used to love those things, man. You know, like 3 was great, but 10 was better, you know. I had a lot of interesting experience with that one. But So that, you know, that kind of stuff went on, and started going to jail. You know, my first experience of going to an institution when I was living with my father, and I had ran away to Alaska and had come back. They had to come and get me and bring me back, and they put me on probation. And I had come back, and I wasn't doing good in school. You know, I really wasn't. The school was a lot harder than a California school. It was really like a small town. I mean, the education was tough, and I just couldn't cut it, you know. And I remember I had come back from Alaska running away. I was on probation and living with my dad. And in a small community, I'm going to get honest with you, they know what's going on with you. This community is like 15,000. They knew Steve Galanda Jr., Steve Galanda Sr. My dad had been in jail for drinking and driving and hang out down. The cops know you. Small town, they know you. It's like we know each other in here. And supposedly a bicycle was stolen, and they accused me of taking it. And you tell you the truth, to this day, I didn't take the bicycle, but they put me into jail because I think the court system knew that, you know, living with my father, the way he was living and drinking and stuff wasn't good for me. So they had to use a legal excuse to put me into a James Ranch or YA type situation, and they had put me in there. And I remember sitting in that cell. I was 16 years old, 17 years old, and I remember I was just like flabbergasted. I didn't know, why am I in here? I didn't steal that bike. You know, I didn't have anybody coming to visit me like my father. I mean, I was there by myself. There was no family members coming to see me or anything. So where I was at, one more time, I was left to my own thinking devices of what to do. I'm a kid. I don't know what's going on, so I ended up going to this like ranch, or it was up in the mountains, and real structured, and we went to school. We used to go to school with the girls that were also incorrigible. It was a school called Maple Lane, and boy, I used to love going to school then. You know, I mean, my grades picked right up. So it was like a co-ed type of school thing they had there. And anyhow, I got out of there. I did pretty well in there. I was always like, they would grade you for how you made your bed. Like, my bed was always Bonnaroo. You could drop a quarter on, that thing would just bounce right off of there, you know. And I played pool there, and like I said, I was very athletic, and I got into sports and everything. Well, I left there, and I came back to California, and paroled down. I came down with my mother to live with my mother because, you know, they're not going to put me back with my father because that was the reason why they had put me in there. Really, I mean, even though I supposedly had stole this bicycle and was on formal probation. So I had gotten down here, and it's, you know, it's the 66, 67 Monterey Pop Festival thing was going on, and that's when really things started jumping around here. And I remember getting down here, and my cousin had some marijuana and LSD, and that's where my drug usage started. That experimentation, along with, you know, the drinking I was already doing at the time. And needless to say, staying with my mother, I was going to Lincoln High School. I was once again, I was pretty incorrigible. You know, I mean, I was doing fairly decent in school. You know, I always had a little hustle in me. I'd have the girl type my stuff in typing class, and I managed to keep my grades okay. But I had picked up the alcohol. I was working at Isis Liquor Store on Ray Street, and I used to go clean it and mop the floor at night and sweep. And I used to take the boxes out. Well, needless to say, like, not all the boxes were empty. And I used to take out, like, full cases of Royal Gate vodka, you know, and I would go, because I lived next door, I'd go stash it in my basement. So, you know, I was a pretty popular guy on campus, you know, always had the vodka on a Friday night. And our thing was, in those days, we'd go out and get drunk, and we would cruise around downtown. There used to be a place where you cruise in downtown San Jose. All the lowriders would go down there and lowride and playing I Heard It Through the Grapevine and all, you know, all that stuff. And so we'd cruise around down there. My thing was, as I look back at it today, I like to fight. And I would sometimes see three people at, like, front of the Jose Theater, and I would just get out and just whip the shit out of all three of them. You know, as I look back at that now, that kind of behavior was, see, I fought a lot from even when I was in grammar school, in junior high. I mean, and that's just what I did. I fought a lot with guys, you know, And when I started drinking, I fought even more, you know. And as I look back at it now, it was, see, all those things that had gone on with me as a kid, being insecure and attention deficit, whatever, type of things played into my behavior, see. I was getting attention from my buddies, Steve, doing, you know. And as I look back at it now, that it was a symptom of my ism, you know. And, you know, that went on for a while. And let's see what happened at that point. My mother could not no longer handle me because I was going out Friday nights, drinking and stuff. And I went back up to live with my father. I was off whatever it was, probation from that YA place. I went back to live with my dad up in Washington. And I lasted up there for a while and ended up moving back. Wait a second, I had come back here on a Christmas holiday. And this is a pretty interesting story. My old buddies were still here, and we used to like to do crazy things like going to Calero. They have a cave up there where supposedly there's Indian ghosts and stuff. Calero is a cave that I don't know if it's still up there or not. And I think it was on a Friday night, we got us some Pagan Pink. You know, that was the big wine drink in that day, Pagan Pink and whatever else we had, and we all got pretty drunked up and went into that cave up there to check out these spirits and stuff, you know. Went in there and we're all crawling around. Needless to say, there was nothing going on, and we ended up coming back to town. And so we came back to town, and we had a $5 bill on us, and we pull into a gas station on Bird Avenue in San Carlos. And we had given the gentleman, the attendant, $5. We had pumped $1 worth of gas. So we're sitting there for a while. This guy doesn't come back with our $4. I mean, we know we'd give him a $5 bill. So one of us got out and we said, hey, you know, we gave you $5. Where's our change? He says, hey, man, you don't have no change coming. So, you know, here we are. I mean, I just told you I like to fight. So I jump out. And there's four of us. We all jump out. So you got the one attendant and there was two biker type guys working on their bikes or something in the repair area. So a little confrontation goes on. Naturally, these two guys come over. Next thing you know, we're throwing chingazos. Chingazos is a word you use when you're fighting, okay? So we're throwing some chingazos, and I don't know who got the better of who today or what, but I know we were all like 16, 17, and we're thumping with guys that are way older than us, I mean, you know, because we had heart, you know, and, you know. So anyhow, We start to leave, and I guess one of the guys that were inside the bay had a friend across the street. So this guy turns, he comes out of his house, and he's got like a 10-22 automatic rifle that you can just spit them bullets up. You know, you ever shot a gun where you shoot it up in a tree and all the leaves come down? So he starts blasting some caps at us. We're driving like a 54 Chevy. He's blasting all these caps at us, and I got shot in the arm. And I remember going to O'Connor Hospital. And I'm bleeding, blood coming out of my sleeve and everything, you know. And they wouldn't take me in there, you know. Like, do you have insurance? Like, no, I don't have insurance. So I am bleeding and stuff. And you know, to say I got a resentment, right? You know? So they took me to Valley Medical Center. And so anyway, I'm in Valley Medical Center. And the next day, these detectives come in. They go, is your name Steve Galanda? I go, yes. Well, we're here to investigate an armed robbery attempt at this INCO Exxon gas station on San Carlos. I said, what are you talking about, you know? So, you know, I explained to him what happened, you know, that we'd went in there. I explained the exact story I just told you, and he says, okay. So he leaves, and about an hour later, some girl that had a crush on me in high school, named Gail, she comes in, she brings me like a Playboy, and she brings me the newspaper. She goes, oh, I can't believe it. On the front page, it says, Hell's Angel thwarts armed robbery attempt. You know, like, back in San Jose in those days, they would put almost anything in the newspaper. If you got arrested for 3 marijuana cigarettes, it was on local. You know, punk arrested at local high school, 3 marijuana cigarettes and some glue, you know. So this is like a shock to me, you know. Here I am, I'm under suspicion of robbing this station, you know, and this Hell's Angel is a hero, you know. So I ended up having to go to court over this. So I go to court, and, you know, back in those days, I mean, I looked up to people that had some color, let's say, you know, and I walk into this court. I'm with a friend named Ismael Z, and he turned out to be a sheriff years later. He's one of us, but he won't cop to it. But anyhow, I go in there with Ismael, and like both sides of this courtroom on the second floor are just lined with club members, you know, like mama's sitting there, they got their little glasses on, and here I am, you know, 16-year-old punk kid. I'm walking down through the thing, and they're looking at me, checking me out and stuff. And so I go into the courtroom, and I was down there on that Christmas, for Christmas vacation with my mom, from my dad's house. And DA tells me, I says, look, I'm not staying for any trial or anything. I mean, I'm going. I mean, you already know what happened. You know, I ain't staying here for no trial. And he goes, well, we had made a deal with this guy. So they had made a deal, and they dropped it down to a misdemeanor. And, boom, I walked out of there and I was on my merry way, you know, the man's name was Spaghetti Joe. I'll never forget it. I mean, he'll play into the story a little down the road. But, you know, that's the way that I was. You know, I would think that got my attention, getting shot. You know, I mean, it never got my attention. I was 16, 17, never got my attention, you know. So I went back up to Washington for a while, lived with my dad, and then I made my final plunge back to California. And I came back down here, and I had no place to go. I ended up, I stayed with my mother for a while, then I got a car, and I was sleeping on my panel. And back in those days, it was party, party, party. It was like, it was on. You know, let's go up to Villa Montalvo. That's a place where artists, there was a grant passed on for artists, you know. And you get out there, and you have your little guitar, and, you know, ding, ding, you know, do whatever you wanted to do, and everyone run around and have their little bags of dope for sale, and all the little hippie chicks would come in there, and it was a gas, you know, and going to Santa Cruz and sleeping on the beach and all that stuff. So that's kind of the way life was for me, you know, and to tell you the truth, I mean, I had a lot of fun, but I can also remember back that I also had a lot of misery. I had a lot of misery behind it, you know. I had a tendency of doing some loose things. I was loose. I would go to jail, you know, and get out of jail. Go to jail, get out of jail. And it became a cycle for me, you know. I mean, I don't consider myself a career criminal or anything, but most of my criminal offenses were like out of Zap Comics or Mad Magazine. They were something that you really laugh about, you know. My first felony conviction, I was around Christmas time. I had found a purse at Valley Fair, and there was a credit card in it. And I remember me and a buddy of mine were running around, and it was Christmas time, you know. I mean, got to have a leather jacket, and got to have. We're charging all this stuff. We're just having a good old time. And I happened to go in there fairly intoxicated on barbiturates, you know, and I thought I was just hip, slick, and cool. And I signed my own name to the card, you know. So a couple days later, I go by my mother's house, you know, because she would usually give me a couple bucks, or I could take a shower there, or do what I had to do, and oh, the detectives were here, and said, son, you better turn yourself in. So I ended up turning myself in, and they ended up putting me in Max Row. I'll never forget it. I got it put in with a fairly smaller guy than me, you know, and he tried to get, like, aggressive with me, and I remember I had to beat the crap out of him. I was 18 years old. I never forget that. This guy was, I don't know, he wanted to make a sissy out of me or something, you know, and I ended up beating the shit out of him. When I went in, he had the bottom bunk, but I'll tell you, when I left, I had the bottom bunk, and he was on the top. I never could figure it out. I had never been to jail before in my life, but, I put two and two together and had to dance with him a little bit, you know. So, anyhow, I got a little bit of jail time out of that and got out, carried on with my life like nothing had changed. You know, got out, and the first thing you do was naturally to get loaded, you know, was go to Villa Montalvo, go to Santa Cruz, go to the B-ends, you know, whatever. I didn't know any better. So one more time, I get arrested again, you know, and this time I'm leaving a friend of mine's, this is probably a month, 2 months later, you know, I leave a friend of mine's house, and it's on Kirtner and Meridian. There's an apartment building, there's a school across the street called Bagby, I believe. They play little girls softball there today. I don't know all these little facts because I drive by there all the time. But anyhow, I was broke. I was renting a room somewhere, and I didn't have a TV set. And I remember I went by that school earlier in the day, and I seen this TV set in this room. I just eyeballed that TV. So I went to my buddy's house, and we're drinking Red Mountain. You know, that's the fashionable thing to buy, $1.59 a gallon. And I got smashed. So it was like 1 o'clock in the morning, and I was going to walk back to my room. It was over on the Alameda. So I ended up leaving, and I remember going to that school. And I went over there, and I looked in that big glass window, and there's that TV, you know. And what can I tell you? Had a pair of cowboy boots on. Smash! Kicked that window right in. And this is like 1 o'clock in the morning, you know, like plate glass. Imagine the noise that it made. So it makes all this noise. And I turn a light. I go in there, and I go. It's on a roller, and I go to roll the TV out of the room. And it's got one of these things like, you know, those door stops on it. And I roll it, hit the stop, and it went over, and I broke it, you know. So I'm pretty flabbergasted at that point. And, well, I got to get something, you know. So here I am. I'm looking around all the little kids' desks, opening them up, looking for milk money and stuff, you know. So I don't think I got very much milk money, but I know one thing happened for sure. Them lights came on. There was about 6 357s looking me at the face, you know. One more time, Steve's back to the good old county jail. You know, that got to be quite the routine for me, you know. That was like my second felony. And so I started to learn how to play the system a little bit, got in there, you know, got into the jail. I kind of knew the ropes from before. Got my little 4 months, went to Elmwood, got out. When I was at Elmwood, I would like, at that time, there was plenty of Reds out there, you know. I mean, in those days, when you went to jail and you went to Elmwood, you were pretty lucky because there was a lot of drugs out there. And when a guy used to get too wasted, like the cops didn't want to carry, they used to throw you on a sheet and drag you down the hallway, you know. And needless to say, I went down that hallway a few times, you know, drugged on a sheet into the little hole, and they would transform me back to the jail. You know, I would get out of jail one more time and just pick up right where I left off. Santa Cruz, let's go up to the Fillmore. Oh, let's talk about the Fillmore. We go up to the Fillmore. Oh, yeah. There's some Janis Joplin's playing on Friday night. Let's go up there. Go on up there. Got a girl with me or a couple friends. And I used to go up there. I wouldn't come on back for 2 weeks. I would meet people up there and come on over here. They got the stash. They got it going on. And the guys that want us over, they want to get into my pants, my girlfriend's pants. And, you know, just all free love. You know, I mean, that's what was going on. So that kind of stuff went on. Fillmore, the partying. You know, I had probably held down some jobs in between then and stuff. But like once again, arrested again. I got arrested again. And this time, when I got arrested, it was for drugs. I got arrested for barbiturates. I remember I was down at Denny's restaurant in downtown San Jose, and I was with a couple buddies of mine, and we're trying to mac on the waitress. Larry wanted me to tell what mac meant. Well, mac means is when you think you're a playboy and you're really going to run a game on her, and she's going to be the one, you know. So we're in there macking on the waitress, and needless to say, we must have been macking too heavy because the cops came. And I had a bag of Reds in my pocket. They used to, like, bag them up real tight, and they would tie them in a cellophane bag, and they would clip the end. Well, the guy that I got these from was fairly new at the game, and he didn't clip the bag real close, and it was real far away. It was real fluffy, you know. So I had this bag on me. And they end up arresting me only for drunken pug, letting my friends go. And I remember I was back at the paddy wagon, and I'm thinking, man, I got these drugs, what am I going to do with them, you know? And so the only smart thing to do was, like, stick them in my mouth, you know? So I stuck them in my mouth, and I got down to the drunk tank, and they had, like, a sliding door you go in, and there's like a barbed wire type thing here, and you got to talk through this thing, and they're asking my name, what's your name? Steve. 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 Yeah, Steve. Yeah, you know, I'm talking, you know, and I guess that part of the bag came out of my mouth, you know. So they had like a button there they would push for the goon squad to come in, you know. Beep. There's like about 4 cut. Bam, boom, slam, slam. I mean, you could hear it. Boom, bam, boom, bubble. You know, they had the stuff out of my mouth. And so I ended up getting arrested for that, and you know, I started to play the system pretty good. And they had a place called California Rehabilitation, or CRC, and the nickname was Disneyland. That's where they used to put you when you were in danger of becoming a drug addict. And at Corona, Narco is another place they call it. And I ended up going down there and got my first state number in California, N34866. I'll never forget it, okay? I get down there. I couldn't figure out what was going on. You know, I was playing handball and getting suntans, lifting weights. And I was in a group where they had put me in. It was attack therapy, right? And I couldn't figure this one out. Like, I remember my counselor told me, you tell so-and-so that his mother wears combat boots, you know. And, you know, this big black guy, I can't remember his name, but he's never used to take showers. He was big, you know. And I told him that, you know. And we never got in a fight over it. It's really weird, you know, because he was like my next slept on the other side of me or something. We just never got into it. But, you know, I never could understand then what that was going to do to help me, like, change the way I was living. I couldn't figure out this program. So anyway, I bounced in out of there for a few times and got out, and I ended up making a geographic. I went up to Washington State, and, you know, needless to say, everything that I had done here, I took that with me up there. I'm going to try and shorten this up a little bit because I want to kind of get into what it's like today. So I go up there, and, you know, my drinking and using never changed. I was loose. I would get up there. I loved to party. I loved to go to the lakes, you know, whether it was boats, whatever was going on, whether it was fun, I was there, you know. So I went back up to Washington. I was carrying on as before, and I ended up getting arrested up there for... We had went to a beach at Lake Sutherland. This is out of Port Angeles, Washington. I went into this resort, bought some beer, and I put it in a van. I was driving this van for a friend of mine, so I put the beer in the van, and me and this guy, we were out drinking on the beach. There's all these girls out there and stuff, and we're drinking this beer and stuff. Well, this guy comes out, and I want you to leave because you haven't paid your beach fee, you know. So I got a beer in my hand. I try to get a hold of him to throw him in the lake, but I didn't want to spill my beer. So my partner comes over and grabs him, takes him out there, throws him in. Like, he's holding the guy down. Like, I think he's going to drown this guy. So I kind of like, I go, come on, man, we got to get out of here. So I jump in the van to leave. I says, come on, let's go. And we leave. And I'm, you know, I kind of drove kind of erratic leaving, and we left. So a couple days later, I was in a bar that I drank at downtown. It was a real popular place. They played Pink Floyd music constantly. I mean, you walk in there any time of the day, and the Dark Side of the Moon was playing. You know, I mean, constantly. I mean, Pink Floyd, Dark Side of the Moon, or whatever, you know. So I'm sitting in there drinking my beer, and like about 10 cops come in, and they end up arresting me for second-degree assault with intent, that I intended to run the owner, which would be William Curran, over with a vehicle. And you know what? I can tell you today, honestly, from my heart, and God only knows this, I never seen that man. And I believe he never really was there. It was one of those things. I was back in Port Angeles again, this small community where they could use some kind of thing to get me out of their town. Now, they do this type of stuff. I mean, it's a fact of life. You know, there's a lot of like men that go to prison. There's a percentage of them that say, you know what? I didn't do it. I'm an innocent man. I believe that today. You know, that's just the law of averages, percentages. Nothing is perfect. To say that no person has been in prison for something they didn't do is not true. So, you know, I ended up fighting this, and I got some dump truck lawyer out of Seattle, Washington. His name was William Prince. And he was truly a dump truck. You know, he talked me into having a trial by judge. I mean, what I know today is having one judge give you a verdict and 12 people give a verdict is a whole different odd. You know, so this judge ended up, you know, we went through all the rigmarole in the trial and blah, blah, blah. And they found me guilty, and they sent me to state prison, which is it's the old territorial state prison in the state of Washington. It's called Washington State Pen, or better known as Walla Walla, you know, the land of double wallas. And, you know, I can resort back to the time that I sat in that juvenile hall detention center when I first went in. I was angry. I was innocent. I shouldn't have went to prison, you know. And they sent me there. You know, they had assigned me another attorney out of that same town, and we had filed an appeal, you know. And needless to say, when I left there, very angry. I was pretty calm when I was in there. They had me on Valiums. And I was pretty calm up to that point, and, you know, I just a lot of anger built up in me, and there was an Indian guy in there with me. His name was shot with two arrows. And I'm going to tell you something. Our cell was up on the second floor, and there was a bunch of cells, and all the people were downstairs, all the offices. We tore that place up. We burned. We watered. I mean, we flooded that place. They were singing the blues when me and shot with two arrows left to go to Walla Walla. So that's where a lot of anger was once again manifested in me. I ended up going to Walla Walla, and I went through a receiving center first, and I had gotten there. And, you know, like doing time, it really wasn't anything new, but, you know, I had hit the big time. I had hit the joint, okay? The joint is a place that really fascinates, for some reason, a lot of women. You know, like really what goes on in there, you know? I remember getting there and driving in, you know, the double gate, like with the bus, you know, and I was a fish, you know, and they put a fish in a certain area where they house you and stuff, and, you know, I was pretty good at holding my mud, but tell you the truth, I could say I was in fear. I was in fear because I didn't know what was going to go on. You know, I mean, I knew I could handle myself, but I was in fear, you know, and I got in there. Being there, you know, for the first time in that atmosphere, and, you know, I've got convicted murderers around me. I have dings. A ding is a person who is criminally insane that does criminal-type things, and they're nuts. You know, like kill people and cut their head off and stuff like that. Well, they had these type of dings running around there. You know, they also had sissies running around there. There was one called Brandy that was in there, and she used to love to flash her ass. You know, like all the men would be watching a movie on a Friday night before the lights went off. She just loved walking right down the middle of the aisle with her tight Levi's. I mean, it looked like a nice woman's ass to me. You know, and so, you mean, that was the way it was in there, you know, and, you know, I always adapt real fast. You know, I was lucky that I knew somebody that was from San Jose. He had got busted for armed robbery while I was in Army at Fort Lewis. The name was Luce. The Luce, we used to call him. Bruce F. And we hooked up, and, you know, I got in a cell with him. And so everything, you know, everything all worked out, you know what I mean? And, well, at that time, there was a lot of, like, unrest, because Washington State has a lot of Indians, you know, and when I drive up there, there's a water tower there, and there's this guy, wait a second, There's a water tower there, and there's this guy up in the water tower, right? And they end up, like, Life magazine took a picture of him, like, being up there, because he was American Indian movement, and all these people used to take food up there to him and stuff. And, you know, that. So I get in there, here's all this unrest. We've got the American Indian movement going on, and I just get in there, and I remember I had a cell. I ended up getting a bottom cell. It was like the Bonnaroo cell, you know what I mean? If you work your way around and manipulate and stuff, got me at the bottom tier. I was on the bottom tier, and the end of my tier was a scaffold where they used to, and they still hang you in Washington State. I mean, if you're going to die, they're going to hang you there. The scaffold was in a room right down the end of my tier. And I can remember that, you know, those things like that. I can remember, you know, the riots that we had in there. We had the riots from burning and flooding and bringing us food, and we were in there for months, you know, like in our cell, little four-man cells for months. And I remember all those things today like it was yesterday, because it's important for me to remember where I came from. You know, when we eventually got off after rioting, I had hooked up with a guy that was a promising middleweight boxer out of Tacoma, Washington. His name was Manny. He was a bad little dude. He was appendextrous, meaning he could hit you hard with both hands. His sparring partner, I was like a light heavyweight, and he got me into boxing when I was in there. And we ran together, okay, and it was like 1-2. And the type of philosophy that I lived by then, being angry and under my situation, was I would rather be feared than loved, you know. And if you're a new guy coming into that prison, and I knew that you were getting drugs out of the visiting room, you're going to bring them to me. Okay? If you didn't bring them to me, you'd be sporting a black eye around the yard for a while. You know, so that's the way I was. I was a beast, no fear, so fierce. You know, that's the way that I had become. I was so angry, vented up from being in there for something I didn't do. You know, and I was lucky, though, you know, when I would be laying in my bunk sometimes, I would pray. I would pray to God, God, you know that I didn't do this, and I got this appeal, and you know, help me. And I managed to go into a lockup with a lockup there. It's called Big Red, and that's where they put you if you're really a bad boy. I got jacked up for smuggling out of the visiting room, and the goon squad come in, want to give me a finger wave. A finger wave is where they stick your finger up your ass to see if there's drugs there. And I told them, hey, you ain't doing that to me. So I got a basket out, and I plopped it out for them and give it to them. So I ended up going to the hole. I mean, I know they love handling that. Well, they probably had plastic gloves or whatever. But I ended up going to the hole. And I was in the hole for a while, and they put me up in these five cells, what they call Big Red. There was a guy named St. Peter, and he was a lifer. He's never going to get out. He killed somebody, never going to get out. And they had the misfortune of letting him go out on a dinner pass with some folks in town. He escaped, you know. So when they caught him, they put him back. They put him in those five little cells. Well, they put me up in those five little cells, and he was my next-door neighbor. I remember him telling me, Steve, you know what, Steve? I'm going to be here for the rest of my life, man. And he told me, you don't have to stay here the rest of your life. You don't have to keep doing what you're doing, Steve. You know, and I heard that, you know. But you know what? I didn't know any other way. At that time, I'm in there locked up, but I heard what the man told me. You know, to make a long story short, because I'm already running out of time, like Laurie did last week, is I got out on appeal. They ended up re-sentencing me, and I got out. I was on probation, and I came back down to California. And, you know, I ripped and run for about 5 years, drank, you know, drunk drivings and stuff and all that. I ended up, I mean, altogether in my career, I've acquired 13 DUIs in my career. And, you know, once again, the type of alcoholic I was, I even managed to get a drunk driving when I was on work furlough at Elmwood, you know, while I was supposed to be working. And, you know, so that kind of tells you the way it was, you know. Come back, get a job, lose the apartment, go to jail. I mean, it went on and on. I did about 8 years out of my life in jails and institutions. You know, what happened for me was I had gotten arrested for like three drunk drivings at one time. I was going to court a lot, and I'm getting all these cases consolidated. And I got in front of one judge, and he gave me an option to either do 18 months in jail or do 6 months in Elmwood and 6 months in recovery house. And I figured, well, let me check this out. So I checked. I said yes. But something had changed in me. You know, that last time, I don't know if it was awakening, a moment of clarity, whatever it might be, but, you know, I was tired. And what I really was tired of, I was tired of going to jail, man. I was tired of it. I mean, you know, I keep doing the same things over and over. I was getting sick of doing the same things over and over again. I ended up being out there for 6 months. I mean, I got my old job back, got my Bonnaroos for the kitchen. I was a butcher, had the big, nice bed, and guys bringing me smokes and the regulars, you know. And someone came up, did you want to, like, toke a little bit? And I says, nah. And it was a few weeks later, I started calling AA meetings at the Quonset Huts out there. This is old Elmwood. And I started going out there. I started listening to these guys that had come in there. And I didn't identify how they looked. You know, stuffed shirts, white shirts, older. Nah. But I started hearing something there. It was recovery. They're sober. They had changed their lives. And what I had done was I had an open mind. So when I got a chance to go to the recovery house, I had reservations still. You know, I knew alcohol had kicked my ass, literally. And I had to do drugs one more time. On December the 25th, 1981, I did some crank and some weed with my girlfriend at the time, and that was the last time I've ever gotten loaded with drugs. My sobriety is December the 26th, 1981. I get to Pathways. Timing is something, you know, like December the 31st, 1981, New Year's Eve. And they had parties there at this house that night. They were having a New Year's Eve party. I remember there were 60 residents, like 12 women and 40-some guys, and I remember driving up there, and there was some guy that had done time with Freddie M., and he told me, Steve, give yourself a break. And then, you know, they're having this party that night. I started seeing people that I knew that I used to do jail time with that are clean. So I got that attraction there. And, you know, the girls that night, they were all dressed up and had their nylons on, all looking good, and guys coming in with leather jackets, and they're pulling up on motorcycles out front. I mean, I really got attracted to what was going on because I seen people like me that had changed their life. You know, I'm grateful for Pathways City. I go down there, I've been going down there a lot lately, you know, try to give back what has been given to me. And I remember Pathways very well. I was there for 6 months. You know, I started my life all over again there. I got a job, $5 an hour. When I was able to go to work while I was there for a while. 2 years later, I became a supervisor of the same shop. I was working for $5 an hour. I had like 12 men working for me. You know, a couple years after that, I ended up starting my own business. Had gotten married. I started my own business. I was selling tools. I opened a tool store. I used to have like a tool truck, and I opened up a tool store. You know, these are like pipe dreams to me, you know, to look back at. Now, I never thought that I would ever, like, accomplish something like that, but I did. You know, and I had a real good life for, you know, probably my first 15 years of sobriety. I mean, I was married. I wasn't really happily married, but I was married. I could buy anything I wanted. You know, there's years there where I made, like, $100,000 a year. You know, there's times where I owned, like, 3 Harley Davidsons. You know, I owned a Harley Davidson repair shop. I mean, material things, you know, owned a rental home, had a brand new condo, all new furniture. The wife had all the jewelry and et cetera, you know, on a material plane. My last 3 years, though, have been probably my greatest growth and recovery, you see. I remember my 15th year birthday. If you're new here tonight or if you've been around here for a while, if you're going to have a party for yourself, plan it for yourself. Don't wait for us alcoholics to do it for you. Most of the time, we'll fail you, let me tell you. So I had this big party. A bunch of friends showed up, and everything was wonderful, you know. And call what you like at that time. I had like a midlife crisis. I was riding Harley Davidsons, you know, running around with the outlaw types, so to speak. And my attitude had changed. I wasn't positive anymore. You know, I wasn't that much into my recovery anymore. I was dry. I was a dry drunk. I was dry, wasn't working a program. So unless I'm spiritually fit, guess what happens? Old Steve unveils, and my disease manifests in all kinds of areas. Prestige, money, you know, and that's what had happened. Harley Davidsons. You know, I had ended up leaving my wife because really, you know what, we never should have been married. You know, honestly. And I tried and tried and tried with her. It's never worked. I hold up my end of the relationship, and I hope she holds up her end. I'm not going to debate with her over it today. But I had to leave. So, you know, here I am. You know, I got my motorcycle, midlife crisis, single, do what I want. And one more time, you know, all the things I've been telling you early about myself manifested. Riding the motorcycles, the Hollister 50th year was going on. You know, I had mentioned, you know, the Hell's Angels at this podium, and I know a lot of them in San Jose, and I'm sure they wouldn't mind me sharing this, you know. I mean, if anybody's got any membership things they want to say, you know, I gave you my name. I know most of them anyhow. But I started running around with the red and white, going to their parties, and, you know, that was part of that prestige I was looking for when I was younger, you know. And, you know, I respect those people, don't get me wrong. That's what they do, you know what, and I found out that's not what I want to do. And that's okay. You know, I had to find that out for myself. And I remember I had like a wake, and I kept my cue stick at a bar that, you know, is pretty much of all the bikers go to. And it was on a Sunday, and I picked up my cue stick there, and I knew that was it for me. That type of lifestyle was, I caught myself. As dry as I was, there was something working in my life, which Jesus called God today, that opened my eyes up. So my eyes were opened up one more time in sobriety, and needless to say, the following years, you know, I have closed my business up. I went through a clinical depression about a year and a half after my divorce, complicated by a lot of different factors. I don't want to go into that. But I managed to get through like a real clinical depression. It's a real thing. It's like the commercial says, like you just don't turn it off. I went through that, I managed to work myself through that and get myself back on track. And I closed my business last year. So basically, today I'm starting out all over again, you know. And, you know, I realized today, you know, that this is an inside job. And it was probably necessary for me to go through all these things in the last 3 years to find out where I'm at today with my growth. You know, I'm grateful for the things I went through. I mean, at the time I wasn't, but now that I look back, it was there's been a lot of growth in me that I know of and other people that know me. So I'm starting out all over again today, and it's okay. You know, it's really okay. I'm really plugged into sobriety lately. Like I tell you, I've been on fire about sobriety. I mean, I come to these Monday night meetings sometimes, and I just love hooting and hollering, and yeah, that's what it's all about. And I feel so good about it, you know. I mean, it's great, you know. And there's a lot to sobriety here if you're new, you know. Like, I've heard it said before, like, you know, if you think it's boring around here, you're probably boring, you know. And it's probably true, you know. Like, I used to, like, think that type of stuff, but you know what? I've really learned how to plug in around here. And, you know, I can tell you about the double Wallace at Walla Walla and all the things that went on there, but I can also tell you this about walls. We have to let the walls down, you know. And that's what I've managed to do. And it hasn't been quickly. It hasn't been quickly for me. But you know what? I have been able to let the walls down and let some people into my life to really love me, okay? And I give them that equal love unconditionally. You know, that's a beautiful thing, you know, to have someone that really cares about you, you know, because I know when I was a child, I really know what love was. All I know is, as I look back at it now, I wasn't getting that, see? I wasn't getting a father that loved me, that went to ball games with me, see? I grew up incorrigible. I grew up, like my report card said, Steve's a nice kid, but lack of self-control is his dilemma, you know? And I had to learn through all those things, you know? So, a gratitude list, a lot of people would get up and say, I've got the car, I got the Olay, the white picket fence, I got the Harley Davidson. You know what? My gratitude list is different today. Is I have a whole new lease on life today. You know, I'm starting all over again. I'm $40,000 in debt from credit cards last year. My disease manifested into gambling, another thing I've had to look at. But it's okay. You know, I don't give that any power. You know, I mean, there's a solution for that. I'm just going to file bankruptcy. You know, that's what the bankruptcy is for. You know, so, you know, that's there's a solution to everything around here, you know, and that's just one more thing that we're entitled to do. You know, I'm a member of society also. I mean, there's a lot of businesses that fail, big businesses that fail, you know, and I don't go through any guilt feelings behind that. You know, so what I'm trying to tell you guys tonight is, you know, it is an inside job, and I'm really grateful that I've been able the last 3 years to take a look good. I'm grateful for that I can look at myself and change and really see some results, you know. And it's a beautiful thing, you know, because, you know, sobriety is a beautiful life. But you got to give yourself a break. You have to give yourself a chance. You have to be open-minded, see. You have to let us into your heart. You have to let us love you till you can love yourself, you know. You let them little walls down. If there's any windows on that wall, just open a window up or something now and again, you know, and let us know you're there, you know, because I don't know how you feel. You know, I can't go around to every person in this room and say, how's it going, Joe? How's it going, Mary? I can't do that. I would like to, but I can't. So sometimes it takes a little effort from you guys. You have to reach out, you know, and meet us. Meet us halfway, you know. I'll share this last thing with you guys. You know, my faith has also been great lately. I'm undergoing a combination therapy for a potential life-threatening disease with my liver. And I have a great faith in about 3 months, it's not going to be like that for me. You know, I've had some tests from my doctor that this problem in my liver is under control and it's probably going to go into remission. And I have great faith today that I'm going to be healthy, you know. And I'm going to tell you something right now, I'm running about half mass the way I feel right now, You know, I'm not the old person. I used to have a lot of energy and rambunctious and ornery and stuff. I know I act a lot more humble, but still, you know, you guys just wait for a while. If I start getting healthy again, I might get a little rambunctious again. So, you know, but, you know, I'm grateful for that. You know, I'm grateful I'm going through bankruptcy. You know, I'm grateful that I have enough money to live month to month now. It's like I'm a newcomer again. You know, when I got to Pathways with a toolbox and two bags of clothes. You know, all the intangible things that I'm telling you, the inside things, is what I'm grateful for today. You know, and, you know, I'm not just telling you guys this, you know. I'm giving you this stuff from my heart. You know, there's a Latin word called impetco. That's where we generate feelings and love from our heart. It's not from our mind, it's from our heart. You know, and I guess I should tell us a little story about letting go. I mean, but I heard this and it's pretty good. In closing, I'll say this. Some from like the Nature Channel that I picked up, and I apply things to my program that way. You know, there's these Hindu huntsmen, and some of you probably heard this before, and they hunt monkeys. And how they hunt these monkeys is they get a coconut and they hollow it out and they leave a hole big enough for a monkey's hand to get in there. And they fill it up with fruit. And they put a couple more holes and they tie some twine on it to a tree so when the monkey gets his hand in there, you know, he's not going to run off with the coconut. So these Hindu huntsmen have spears and these monkeys come by and they stick their hand in the coconut to get the fruit. See, what happens is they don't let go of the fruit. And the huntsmen come over and, you know, it's all over with, you know. So what I've learned to do is to let go, you know. And that's about the, you know. My problem was I used to leave my hand in the coconut too much, you know. In the coconut. In the coconut. But get you down there. But, you know, so, you know, it's a process of things that go on around here, you know. I could talk about the steps or my sponsor, the men that I sponsor, but, you know, I think I probably made a little bit of sense tonight, you know. And something I'm going to say in closing is, I said this a long time ago, it's kind of stupid, but I'm going to say it anyhow, because I feel like it. You know, if you're new here tonight, keep coming back, okay? If you're going to drink when you leave here, just keep coming back. If it really doesn't work for you out there, just keep coming back. Thank you.